This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
And hello, Hearts of Oak. Thank you so much for joining us on another interview. And it is my honor to have Dr. Ben Carson with us today. Dr. Carson, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be with you.
Great to have you on. And I've been enjoying listening to your book as an audiobook, Create Equal. And it's a huge subject. So it is an honor to have you on discussing such a key issue as race. And let me just bring up on the bottom where people can find AmericanCornerstone.org is your organization. And they can also find you at Ben S. Carson on Getter as well, which we have enjoyed Getter. So Dr. Carson is on Getter. And let me just bring up the book first so people can see that the book that I've been enjoying. I'd encourage our readers either to get it as an audiobook or a Kindle or a hardback, however you normally read or absorb hold of it. Now, Dr. Carson, I was looking and reading into your background. You're as a neurosurgeon and the first in many areas, quite phenomenal. And I guess that brings your experience into understanding people when you look at the brain, which is the center. So your time as a neurosurgeon, I'm curious to find out what that's kind of taught you or made you realize about how we work as people.
Well, as a neurosurgeon, you get to know the human brain is an amazing organ system, the most fantastic organ system in the universe. Billions and billions of neurons, hundreds of billions of interconnections. It can process more than 2 million bits of information in 1 second.
Wow.
But, you know, what is it that makes you who you are? Is it the color of your skin? Is it the texture of your hair or the shape of your nose? Or is it the brain? And when you look at the human brain as opposed to, say, an animal, let's take a dog, you put them side by side, there are many similarities. You know, they both have frontal lobes, parietal lobes, occipital lobes, temporal lobes, cerebellum, brainstem, midbrain. But the dog's midbrain is much better developed than the human. Why? Because that's what's used for reacting. That's why animals react so much faster than people do, cat-like reflexes, things of that nature. But the people have much better developed frontal lobes. That's where you engage in rational thought processing. We can extract information from the past, integrate it with information from the present, project it into the future, a year in advance, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. We can do complex calculations and analyses. That's what distinguishes people from animals. And yet, we have people who are trying to get our children to act like animals. Mm. Look at the color of someone's skin and make a judgment based on that. That's a primary determinant of what happens to you, your race. And that is so beneath what we are as human beings.
Well, that your book is Create Equal, The Painful Past, Confusing Present, and Hopeful Future of Race in America. And reading about your past growing up, you had quite different experience. One experience, I guess, in Detroit, growing up in a predominantly Black community, Black churches and schools, and then over into Boston, and that was quite a different experience. Do you want to kind of just let us know what those experiences were like for you growing up?
Well, you know, as a youngster, I was basically in a Black world. And so race was never a particular issue. Occasionally, you know, you would have some white teachers, you would see white police officers, but, you know, nothing that really had much of an impact on what was going on. And then when we moved to Boston, was the first time I really encountered, you know, unpleasantness because of my race. You know, when a group of young white boys and men, you know, said, let's drown that N-word. And I ran away, of course. I was rather fleet of foot, fortunately. But, you know, you started hearing things of that nature. And when we moved back to Detroit, We were on the white side of the railroad tracks, just on the white side. So I went to a white elementary school. And I was a terrible student. My brother was a terrible student. So, but that's what they expected. So it wasn't anything out of the ordinary. My mother made me start reading books, and my brother also. And, you know, within the space of a year, we went from the bottom of the class to the top of the class. Wow. The students were fine with that. The teachers had a real problem. You know, what in the world is this black kid doing at the top of the class? You know? Had a real issue with it. But, you know, those are things that have changed dramatically. You know, I remember as a youngster, when a black person came on television in a non-servile role, it was a big deal. You called everybody into the living room, hey, come and see this, you know. And now, within the same lifetime, and that's what I must emphasize, within the same lifetime, now you have black admirals and generals and CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and heads of foundations and presidents of universities, including Ivy Leagues. We've elected a black president twice in the United States. We have a black vice president. I mean, to sit around and say that we haven't made substantial progress is a denial of reality that is so easy to see. Doesn't mean that we've reached nirvana. Doesn't mean that we've solved all the problems. But it does mean we've made substantial progress. And shouldn't we build our future on that progress rather than dredging up all the horrible things that have happened and saying that's who we are and that's what we must be? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense, quite frankly.
Moving on to the present, and your chapter 4 is titled Guilt and Victimhood Surrounding Race. This whole concept of because I'm white, I should feel guilty, and because you're black, you should be a victim. Tell us more about that concept and how that is playing out at the moment in the US.
Well, you know, race is being used as a cudgel to beat people into submission, to make white people feel guilty about everything that has happened, and saying that they are the cause of all the difficulties that any minorities have. And of course, if you've got a whole bunch of people feeling guilty, what do guilty people do? They do nothing. They stand around with their head down and hope that nobody calls them a nasty name. And you kind of neutralize them. And then you can go ahead and do things like defund the police and let dangerous criminals terrorize everybody and not guard your southern borders and a whole host of things. And as far as the victimhood is concerned, if you can convince somebody that they're a victim, they are a victim. There's no question about that. And, you know, my mother never allowed us to be victims, and she never accepted excuses. If we ever made an excuse, next thing out of her mouth was a poem called Yourself to Blame. And the next question was, do you have a brain? And if the answer was yes, then you could have figured your way out of it. It doesn't matter what somebody else did or said. And, you know, growing up that way, I think, made a big difference for me. You know, her friends used to always criticize her and say, you can't make boys stay in the house and read books, and you can't treat them like that, and they'll grow up and they'll hate you. And I used to overhear them, and I said, you know, they're right, Mother. But it didn't matter. We still had to do it. She got the last laugh because one son became a brain surgeon and the other one was a rocket scientist.
Well, I mean, I would love to talk more about your life shows actually what you can achieve, and your reading about your background was quite inspirational about working hard and actually just getting glasses, I think, was your story in your book about being able to progress and see the board at the front. But can I ask you about, there's again another concept today which seems to be quite destructive, and that's critical race theory. And I think it's chapter 5 in your book, you go into that critical race theory and the 1619 project, which you won't get into 1690. That's more for US viewers, but for the UK, certainly critical race theory. And you start your chapter with a quote from Lenin, give me 4 years to teach the children, the seed I have sown will never be uprooted. And you seem to me, you talk about, you say the critical race theory is one of the ideological pillars of the groups wanting to fundamentally change America. Tell us what it is and why it wants to fundamentally change America.
Well, there have been people who have never really liked the structure that we had in America. You know, this started more than 100 years ago. Mm. And, you know, a lot of people, particularly in Europe, never felt that our system would work. You can't have a system that's run on the will of the people. You have to have a monarch. You have to have a governing group of individuals who tells you what to do and when to do it. And yet it has worked. But in order to change it, you first have to get people to believe that it needs to be changed, mm. And that it's fundamentally rotten. And that's what critical race theory does. It's based on critical legal theory, which says that all of the legal structures in America were designed to keep white people in power and to suppress others. And of course, if the whole system is built on that, then obviously you can't correct it by a little tweak here and there. You really have to blow up the whole thing and start over again. And you see a lot of people, particularly on the left, you know, advocating that, you know, this is wrong and this is wrong. And we need to change the Supreme Court and we need to change this and that and the other and all of our rules. And of course, it's based on their perception and their desire. Of course, they don't realize that in every system that has tried that, it has not worked particularly well. And all you have to do is look to our south at Venezuela. You know, I've visited Venezuela many times before it turned. It was a beautiful place, pleasant resorts and hotels and museums. We had a great time there. The biggest controversy the people had was whether or not they were the most beautiful people in the world. That's what they argued about all the time. And look how quickly, almost overnight, they went from the most prosperous nation in South America to the bottom, where people are fleeing, trying to get out of there. That's how quickly these things can turn, and that's why you must be extremely vigilant whenever any of your rights are threatened.
Mm. The another chapter in your book I found fascinating was Chapter 7, Media and Big Tech. And that big tech has got a huge impact on our society. And I wonder how you feel that has impacted the conversation we now have regarding race.
Well, it's been a big factor. I do point out that the media played a very important and a very good role in the civil rights movement by exposing a lot of the horrible things that were going on with Jim Crow. But now they have kind of lost sight of why they are the only business that is protected by the Constitution. Mm. It's because they're supposed to disseminate unbiased information to the people so that the people know what their will is. How they know what their will is if they don't get the right information. And they have decided to put their thumb on the scale and push us, you know, toward socialism. And what they probably haven't really fully considered is that the first thing that socialist and communist governments do is completely control the media. So they're sort of making their own grave.
It's a book which deals with a big subject. You probably could have picked easier books. I know you've written a number of books, maybe as a neurosurgeon, I don't know. There isn't much you can go above that. But this is a book on a huge subject. And I'm wondering what was behind the desire to write a book on race?
Well, the fact that I was finding that everything was circling back to race. Even things that really didn't have anything to do with race, somehow this is racism. Mm. And I thought it really was quite ridiculous. So I wanted to really clarify, you know, when you look at things like the George Floyd incident, and, you know, it was played incessantly 24/7, not just in this country, but around the world,
yeah.
To the point that people were thinking that Black unarmed men were being killed by police every day. This was a common occurrence. The fact of the matter is, as I point out in the book, there are more than 50 million police civilian encounters per year in the United States. And the number of unarmed black men killed by police is less than two dozen. And that's the statistics of the Washington Post, hardly a conservative publication.
And what has been their response? Because you take a different line than, as we mentioned, big tech or what the narrative is supposed to be, like critical race theory. You've taken a different line, a more conservative, common sense line, but you're bringing something different to the media conversation. So, I mean, when you brought the book out, what has been kind of the response as you talk about this? As a conservative figure, as someone who served in the Trump administration, what backlash has there been to you on this?
Really, there hasn't been a whole lot. Within 2 weeks, it was on a New York Times bestseller list. You know, they don't like conservative books.
That's true.
but I don't really even consider it a conservative book because I consider it a logical book.
Yeah.
And notice that we take each issue and we analyze it, you know, from more than one point of view, and then see what makes sense. What does the evidence show? And, you know, I try to get people to realize that we, the people, are not each other's enemies. Mm. Enemies are those who are trying to divide us. And one of the key issues that they can use to divide people is something obvious like race. But they're also using age and income, political affiliation, gender, you name it. They're using it to try to divide people, to try to create this sense of, you know, this is a terrible place and we really need to change it. And that's just not the case.
Can I finish on something that's on there under the American Cornerstone Institute? You've got faith, liberty, community, and life. And faith, as a Christian, I know you as a Christian, that you see that as an essential part of life. And I'm wondering how you see the Christian values, biblical values, how you see faith informing our conversation on race.
Well, there's a whole chapter in the book about, you know, religion, faith, and racism, because a lot of people say that the Bible condones slavery, and I actually show where it does not. However, it recognizes slavery. You know, people have to recognize that slavery has been around since there's been human history, with virtually every society. So it's nothing unique. We do need to fight it. There's more slaves in the world today than there have ever been, when you look at human trafficking, and we need to deal with it, rather than dredging up things from the past. But the fact of the matter is, faith tells you to love your neighbor. Mm. And when you get rid of faith, what's left? Cancel your neighbor. Hate your neighbor if they have a different yard sign than you have. And what does that do? Leads to nothing but conflict. There's no good that ever comes out of that kind of attitude. So our faith was a critical part, particularly the development of the United States. The founding document, the Declaration of Independence, talked about certain unalienable rights given to us by our Creator, yeah, aka God. And if they're given to you by your Creator, they cannot be taken away from you by man.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one nation under God, returning to that would return a lot of principles in society. Dr. Ben Carson, I appreciate your time. Maybe just to finish, you can mention the American Cornerstone Institute. Maybe just mention that as we finish so people know what they will get if they go on the website.
Well, I thought I was going to retire after the election in 20, but seeing the way the country was going, I said, I can't do it. I want to enjoy myself on the golf course. So a bunch of outstanding people from HUD joined me in creating a think tank / do tank, American Cornerstone Institute, which focuses on the cornerstone pillars of faith, liberty, community, and life. And we also have a pediatric component called Little Patriots. And we have lesson plans at littlepatriotslearning.com, free of charge, because we make sure that we get underwriters to underwrite everything. You see other people have programs, they say, you know, try it out for free, and then they charge you. We make sure that it's free. And it teaches the real history, good, the bad, and the ugly, but puts it in the right context. not that we are these evil, horrible people, but that we have made mistakes and that we learn from those and we move forward. And that's really the key. And we have a More Perfect Union program to teach adults about how the government works and how they can get involved and what they should be doing and the importance of voting the right way, all of these kinds of things. And all of it's free of charge.
Wonderful. Well, our viewers can go and check that out, as they can go and check out the book, Created Equal, The Painful Past, Confusing Present, and Hopeful Future of Race in America. It was published just on the 2nd of June, so it's just out. Do go and get hold of it yourself. Dr. Carson, thank you for your time today. Fascinating, and it's an honor to have you with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list. Donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.